From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV-LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a live conversation in the studio with Vermont author Chris Tebbets, whose new novel is Me, Myself, and Him, published by Delacorte Press. Before we begin our conversation, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about the book. When Chris Schweitzer takes a hit of whippets and passes out face first on the cement, his nose isn't the only thing that changes forever. Instead of staying home with his friends for one last summer after high school, he's shipped off to live with his famous physicist, but royal jerk of a father, to prove he can play by the rules before dad will pay for college. Or not. In an alternate timeline, Chris's parents remain blissfully ignorant about the accident, and life at home goes back to normal until it doesn't. A new spark between his two best straight friends quickly turns Chris into a gay third wheel, and even worse, the truth about the Whippets incident starts to unravel. As his summer explodes into a million messy pieces, Chris wonders how else things might have gone. Is it possible to be jealous of another version of yourself in an alternate reality that doesn't even exist? With musings on fate, religion, parallel universes, and the best way to eat a cinnamon roll, Me, Myself, and Him examines how what we consider to be true is really just one part of the much, much bigger picture. Chris Tebbets is the New York Times bestselling co-author of James Patterson's Middle School series. Originally from Yellow Springs, Ohio, Tebbets is a graduate of Northwestern University. He lives and writes in Vermont. His main character is also called Chris. I'm going to try to differentiate them as we talk. So, hi, Chris. Welcome to Write the Book. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Thanks for having me here as well.
I'm glad you're here. You've got a great radio voice.
I've come to that conclusion. As somebody with a small ego, I've been enjoying the sound of my own voice for the first time in my life.
That's great. Well, I thought the way we could start today, the beginning of the book is such a sort of important fulcrum on which everything else turns. So I wondered if you would read from the beginning of the book, and then we'll move into our conversation about it.
Sure. The last thing I remember is sucking down a lungful of gas and closing my eyes. My friend Wexler tells me that I set down the cartridge, stood up again, paused like I wasn't going anywhere, and then fell over, almost slow motion, like a tree going down, until I landed face first on the cement. All of that is blank in my memory. When I woke up, if that's what you can call it, the first thing I saw were these yellow and blue streaks moving away from me like paint running down a windshield. On the other side of that, I saw one of Wexler's black Keens, the ones he wore at the restaurant, but just one of them right there in front of my face. Hang on, man. You're gonna be okay. I called the ambulance. It's okay. It wasn't, though. I could see the shoe, and I heard Wexler's voice, but they weren't at that time Wexler's shoe and Wexler's voice. They were just shoe and voice. I had no idea where I was, or how I'd gotten there, or why everything was sideways. The first thing that kind of made sense was the sound of the siren. I knew it was an ambulance. That was good. At least I knew something. And then there were all these people. EMTs and police, more shoes. A cop kneeled down next to me. It was starting to come together. What's your name, son? I tried to answer, but everything came out G-L-A-N-R. Your name? The first words I actually managed were, I'm having trouble speaking. He just shrugged and took his lack of grasp for the obvious somewhere else. I heard Wexler giving them my information. Then they put a big, thick collar around my neck and lifted me onto a stretcher. The back of the ambulance was like this lit portal with night all around it, and I slid right in. My face didn't hurt. I don't know why. It just didn't. I thought the collar was a bit much, but someone took my hand away when I tried to loosen it. And then we were moving. I'd always wanted to ride in an ambulance. It was on the list with helicopter, glider, and yes, fire truck, so I couldn't help at least noticing that it was happening. The whole thing was so much like a movie or TV show that reality kind of got drowned out. Riding in an ambulance was all front and center. I am so screwed wouldn't show up for another 45 minutes or so. At the emergency room, they wheeled me right in. A doctor came into the bay where they'd stuck me and felt around on my face. When she got to my nose, she made this sympathetic kind of sucking sound. What happened to you? She said. Well, I didn't know how to tell her anything but the truth. I did a hit of nitrous oxide and passed out on the cement. My voice was really small, like if I barely said it, it would barely be true. Does my mom need to know about this? You're 18, she said, with the same kind of tone she might use to say you're a dumbass kid in every respect but the law. That part's up to you. I'm not sure how the standard exam is supposed to go in these situations, but I'm pretty sure I got the discount package after that. She gave me another quick once-over, said something about x-rays, and left. I lay there alone for a while, and the shame started to creep in, but also a dose of aggravation with myself. Why couldn't I have just said I fell down on the cement? Wexler came in a little later. He was still wearing his uniform minus the bow tie. How's it going? He cupped my hand just for a second. Does it hurt? He was smiling, too, like he was in on the joke, which basically he was. He knew it wasn't funny, and I knew it wasn't funny, but still, it was kind of funny. Wexler was like my lifeline that night. You scared the crap out of me, man, he said. Did anyone else see it? Nah, he said. Everyone else was gone. I called 911, waited with you, gave them your info. Thanks. And, what? I called your mom, too. I closed my eyes. Of course he called my mom. I'd do the same thing. Not if it was just some basic accident, but with police and an ambulance and all, yeah. Sorry, he said. No, I told him. It's not like I'm going to hide this from her. Have you seen your face? He was smiling again, and I could tell he hoped the answer was no, so he could be the first one to show me. Not yet, I said. Here. He found a pink plastic mirror, the little girl kind. I had no idea where it came from, and I wondered for one weird little moment, did some girl die in here? And then I saw myself. My hair in front was standing straight up, and there were stripes of dry blood from my upper lip to my forehead. My nose had a little quarter-inch gash on the side that didn't look like much and didn't feel like anything. Of course, my nostrils were now completely different sizes. Wexler knocked my hand away. Don't mess with it! Or what? It's gonna stay that way? We both laughed, but only until that little blue curtain opened and I saw my mom standing there. Oh, Jesus. She looked pretty much like someone who had gotten a call in the middle of the night to come get their kid at the hospital. It was maybe 2 a.m. by now. What happened to you? She came over and put a hand on my cheek. Wexler looked around like he didn't know where to be anymore. And I looked up into her eyes and I said, I fell down on the cement.
Great. Thank you for reading that, Chris.
Sure.
That was Chris Tebbets reading from Me, Myself, and Him. There's so much I enjoyed in the book. I gave a little summary, but the alternate timelines were really fun. And the plots that fork, the great characters. I loved Chris's sense of humor, which I guess is also Chris's sense of humor.
To a degree.
The honesty, all kinds of stuff. So let's start with the parallel timelines and the differing plots. After Chris passes out doing whippets, you know, and that scene that you just read, time forks. So how did you decide this would be the momentum of the book?
It was one of those cases when I was a beginning writer, I didn't really believe in that stuff about the story speaking to you and your characters doing stubborn things when they didn't want to do what you wanted them to do. But that's what happened with this. I started writing a traditionally structured novel about a kid getting busted and sent off to live with his father for the summer. And as I wrote and wrote, he wouldn't leave his home in Ohio. He wouldn't get on that plane to California. And I decided to listen to what the story seemed to be trying to tell me, which, you know, long story short, turned out to be that I didn't have to choose between Ohio and California, that I could do both.
Yeah.
Which speaks, for starters, to a lot of fascinations of mine, but I have to always give a nod to the movie Sliding Doors, which was the first time I ever saw somebody treat a narrative in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, although I will say The Wizard of Oz also came to mind a little bit, although we don't get to see Dorothy, you know, in that whole period of time.
Interesting.
But she is in two different places, you know.
There is a Dorothy and Wizard of Oz reference deep in the book.
Yeah, yeah, actually, right. Yeah. So so once you decided to go ahead and let him have two different stories, was that fun?
It was super fun. I mean, I'm a fan of puzzles. For me, writing a novel is very much like, after you get past the first draft, it's like you've created all your puzzle pieces and then you get to play with them.
Right.
And this was like doing two jigsaw puzzles at once with the added layer, you know, sort of take that and then make it 3D, because there are things Chris knows in each of his reality, but then there are things I let the reader in on that he can't know outside of his own singular realities.
Right, sure.
So there's a three-dimensional quality to the reading experience, I hope.
Yes, absolutely. Now, there are great characters as well. Chris is wonderful. His friends Wexler and Anna. And then I like the new friend that he meets in California at his dad's lab, who's a born-again Christian, Gina. I think.
That's right, yeah.
And then there's also a love interest named Swift, so the name is great, too. So I wondered, when you write, do you kind of try to know your characters in the first draft, or do you kind of get to know them as you work through sequential drafts?
I'm in process on that question. I heard Tim Wynn Jones talking about this once, and he was the first person I heard describe it as getting to know the characters on the page, uh-huh. as opposed to what I used to do, which was more character journaling and really learning them before I began to write.
Right, yeah.
This was the first book I've ever done without an outline. So there was a lot more discovery on the page. You know, P.S., my first draft of this book was 120,000 words. The finished book is 60,000 words.
Wow.
So it's not an efficient process.
Yeah.
But it was more organic, and I sort of found them as I went. And you've already alluded to the fact that a lot of this, I say this book is a little memoir and a lot of fiction. So Gina is based on somebody I worked with at Friendly's way back in the day.
Oh, wow.
Wexler and Anna are based on sort of an amalgam of my teen friends, that sort of thing.
Right, yeah. And Chris has a little bit of truth to him?
Absolutely. I mean, the prologue I just read is completely autobiographical.
Okay.
It begins with essentially straight autobiography and then moves deeper and deeper into fiction as it goes.
Right.
But interspersed with what I would call emotional truths that come from my own experience.
Okay, that's fun. Let's see. What was most important to you as you gave Chris two timelines to live in as far as his character's consistency goes? Like, was there anything that was hard to keep the same about him as time changed and actions shifted?
One of the things I discovered about him, and it's a little weird to say him because so much of me is in there, but
yeah.
But that this book is for me, and I don't know if readers will pick up on this or not. I've read some advanced reviews, and some of the folks who take objection to this character say he's kind of a jerk. And for me, the book is in part about self-loathing.
Mm.
And he detests his father. I did not detest my father, for the record. That's part of the fiction. But he sees himself turning into somebody he doesn't want to be.
Right.
In both halves of the story.
Yeah. And yet, as the author, you definitely give us a window into the things that he has in common with his father. You know, his father's a physicist and a math genius, and Chris, you know, he definitely gravitates towards numbers. He notices times on the clock, and that actually is a really interesting thing that you use to help us understand the structure and the chronology of what's happening within these timelines.
Yeah.
And I just remember this one moment where his father tells him what his cell phone password is, and it's 3141, and Chris says, "Yummy, pie."
I wasn't sure if everybody would get that. I'm glad you did.
I did. It was fun. And then there are just other moments. You know, there's a lot of math to the way that his mind works. So, I suspected you kind of wanted us to see that there is, you know, continuity there between the two of them. And there was another moment where he describes his father as like, "We're like cousins." And I thought, he's so deeply in denial about being related to this person.
Right. Dad has a hard time not telling the truth. And I, Chris, the character, has a hard time lying.
Right.
And I describe them as cousins that way.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that was fun. Let's see. You offer forked truths within the timelines, too. And I liked that. Like, this was sort of interesting just within the words on the page. Sometimes you had graphs or you had charts or you had these sort of interesting tables. And one of them was the truth versus what I told her.
Yes.
Her being mom. You know, and then you kind of go through the one and then the other, and that was kind of a fun way that things are forked, although that's the reason that everything else is forked too, but that was sort of fun. So talk about being a little bit unconventional on the page.
Well, I'm going to steal that phrase, forked truths, by the way. Thank you. Because I was working without an outline, and this book is actually, this is my 30th novel, and the first time I've ever actually just done it the traditional way, write a book on spec, sell it through my agent. So I really had free rein in a way I never have before. I've always focused on collaborative writing, ghostwriting, co-authoring, that sort of thing.
Right.
So I just let this one flow the way it wanted to flow.
Okay.
And my mind, I've always felt like I was a liminal person, which is to say, you know, I'm an ambivert. I'm never like one kind of person or another. And so I'm a creative at heart, but I'm a creative with things in boxes and graphs. You know, it's like my left brain and right brain can't decide who wants to tell the story.
Right.
And
okay.
Some of it flowed from that. Some of it's just organic, and those, you know, writers might be able to relate to this. Those moments of discovery you don't see coming.
Right.
And you thought, oh, I didn't know I was going to write that. And I love it.
Yeah.
Some of my favorite stuff is the unforeseen stuff.
Yeah. You just said flowed, and it helped me think of what I was trying to say, which was flowchart earlier. You've got some of those in here, too.
Yes.
One of the things that that Chris is doing in this book, which is a bit like his dad, and he fights that, is that he's lying to his mom. And you have this great moment where he says that his mom has had to put up with a lot of liars, and he himself has always felt that he could be there for her in an honest and genuine way. I may be quoting from the book. I didn't put quotes around it on my question. But so the situation causes him to lie to her, which is a really interesting part of the plot. And I wondered if we can talk a little bit about lies. They make for great conflict, and also conflict is so important in a story. So I wonder if you...
Yeah, it was another moment of discovery for me to realize that everybody but the character you mentioned, Swift, the romantic interest, I believe, everybody lies in this book and everybody tells the truth, which wasn't something I built in consciously, but when I realized it, I ran with that. And part of the reason I like that and I liked playing with the idea of lies, lying has always been difficult for me. So that's just a sort of a personal reflection of, you know, what might be a challenge for this character.
Right. Well, you're from Ohio.
Midwestern niceness.
We're very honest in Ohio. Go ahead.
But the other thing is about the relativity of truth. And so, you know, while the reader can see that both narratives, Chris in each of his, as I mentioned before, in each of his realities can't. And so... we don't always know in our own existence if we're making assumptions and if those assumptions are true. We often assume that they are, and then we get a larger context. Oh, I didn't realize, you know, that this person was coming from such and such a place. And so the relativity of truth for me ties into the whole idea of lying as well.
Yeah.
It all fills up a piece. I'm not sure if that was coherent, but it
yes.
is in my head.
Okay, yeah. It is. Of course, we do know that you at one time hit the concrete hard, so.
Yes, that's right. And I've never been the same.
I mentioned the character Gina. I wondered if you were at all nervous about touching on religion and its associated politics in the book. Did that make you at all like, oh, should I do this?
I don't even know if nervous is too strong a word, because one of my early fascinations that drew me to this story was, in addition to this idea of parallel timelines and this physicist father who echoes my fascination with the multiverse and the idea of parallel realities having some basis in theoretical science, I've also, as it's weird, as a non-scientist and a non-religious person, I do, however, have this fascination with the way in which at least Western Christianity, Western religion, and science seem to be moving toward each other, which is to say they both look for the simplest possible truth.
Mm.
You know, there's the God and there's the God particle in physics, all to answer, you know, what's it all about?
Mm-hmm.
That fascinates me. I was fascinated by this born-again Christian young woman who I worked with at Friendly's way, way back in the day. We played racquetball and we joked and we, you know, went out for food. There was nothing about religion at that time, and I was raised as a religious as anybody I've ever known. So I made a lot of assumptions about what it meant to be Christian. And to this day, some of those are correct. You know, there are reasons for, especially gay people and other folks like me, to be wary of organized religion.
Right.
But I've also met, especially in the course of this book and interviewing a lot of folks, I've met a lot of very forward-thinking, progressive born-again Christians as well.
Right. Great. Now, you just mentioned Chris is gay, and the whole family knows this, and yet he has a middle school stepsister named Violet.
Yes.
Who has a little crush on him, and he says, this is great, he's got a great sense of humor. If I came up and ate the fries off her tray in the cafeteria, she might write about it in her diary that night. That was really fun. So that was hilarious. But it also made me think about how our hormones don't care if an attractive young man or woman is attracted to a different sex than our own, and how painful this all is when you're 13 or 15 or 16 or whatever. And I just thought that that was interesting that you included that whole dynamic.
Yeah, that was another organic moment of discovery in the airport pickup scene. Violet looked over at him as I was writing it.
Yeah.
And he got a little creeped out and he looked to his stepmother and she reflected his own
feelings.
He's like, I'm not imagining this.
Yeah.
And it's a light point in the book. We do return to it, but it's not a major point.
It's not a major theme. But
That was just darkly funny to me.
Yeah, it is. It's funny, but it's also kind of a little bit sad because I remember being, you know, in middle school and just being so confused. And,
yes.
You know, it's like, here's this stepbrother. You know?
And I do give her a moment of clarity near the end of the book, which I won't spoil. But
no.
Violet, there's more to Violet than meets the eye.
Right. And I don't do any spoilers on the show. I wonder if you can talk about writing about teenage romance. It's not genre romance, but just like the actual true romance of teenagers and all those feelings happening for the first time. How?
I really enjoyed writing that aspect of it. This is one way in which I don't share in the character's experience. This character and the gay characters in my YA novels, I only have two, but in both cases, they are what I call incidentally queer characters, which is to say the story is not about the difficulty of being queer in a homophobic society. And I'm certainly glad there are lots of books that take on those really real and sometimes ugly realities.
Right.
But I wanted to have a character who, for my audience and for myself, was comfortable in his skin. And so when the romance begins, it's not like, should I do this? It's like, I can't wait to do this.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I was giving him a high school experience that I didn't have. And in other ways, I was just borrowing from my own experiences that happened a little later in life for me.
Yeah.
But it was a... When I'm writing, I'm always looking to feel something. And when I was writing those scenes, I really felt something. So I knew whether or not it's going to translate to the readers, I knew that I was going to stick with what I was doing there.
Yeah. Now, I may be misremembering this, but one thing I liked, and I think it's true, is that you didn't sort of define him as gay very early in the novel. I think we're well into the novel before he just incidentally, as you say, mentions it. So that was interesting. And I recently interviewed somebody who had written a novel where a character is African-American, didn't say so for a very, very long time. And it only came up very organically when it needed to. And I just thought, of course, that's the way to present people. As you need the information, then the information comes. So
for a story like this, absolutely. That's one of those things I thought, oh, well, nobody will even notice. I'm so glad you just asked this. It's about page 75 before we even find out that he's gay. Very much on purpose, very conscious. We went back and forth a lot about whether to say Chris is gay in the flap copy that you read. But, you know, in practical terms, that's a way to, you know, let certain readers know this is a book for you.
Yeah.
So we did go ahead and reveal that. But that doesn't take away from the fact that his sexuality is just one thing about him.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, this is a very small point in the book, but I loved it. When I'm feeling like life is a little unfair, I have this science math fact that I turn to, which has always made me feel better. And you are the first person I've ever come across who says this exact thing, and you worded it so well. Chris has this in the book. Not only do two people have to come together at exactly the right time, but then this one sperm out of 100 million has to get to the head of the line to ensure it's going to be you who is born, is the context, and not someone else who pops out 9 months later. It's like winning Powerball just by being born. I love that concept, and I love that you put it in there, and I thought it gave Chris this sort of optimism. I don't know, you said that some people think he's a jerk. I don't think he's a jerk. I just think he's complicated.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that, too. Yeah. My agent was the first one to say to me, you know, this is a very optimistic book, and I felt like I was dwelling, it wasn't finished yet, and I felt like I was dwelling in dark themes in that point.
Uh-huh.
And he saw right through that to the ultimate optimism of the book. And it really helped direct what I did from there. And I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yeah. No, I loved that. Okay, let's see. We've already talked about that. Okay, oh yes, this is great. So in one of the timelines, Chris is not being honest with anyone about how and why he passed out in the parking lot behind work. And so his life has taken a different course. He stays in Ohio. And you introduce a character who might have seen the actual moment and who might know the truth. And I'm not going to give anything away there, but just the introduction of this possibility makes Chris very nervous. And I love that threat appeared and that it complicated his life. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about how that serves the book.
In writing craft terms, one of the things I think of is, you know, advice I'll give students, which is if you're feeling a little stuck, take something away from your character.
Mm.
And this character, Mitch, takes away some sense of security that I'm going to get away with this lie and spend my last summer before college, you know, just the way I had always imagined. And now suddenly, maybe not.
Right.
So I definitely needed an obstacle for him. I needed some form of antagonist for him, but I wanted him to be a complicated antagonist, which he does turn out to be. And I liked writing those scenes with that sort of undercurrent of threat, but I don't know, you know, how do you proceed against a threat if you're not sure it's a threat yet?
Right, and the character Mitch Mitchell,
yes,
which is very, and I have to ask you about this other thing that's hilarious, but anyway, the character is, he's weird, or he's not easily, you can't read him very easily, right? And so that made it even better, because it's not something Chris can just figure out by reading his face or his gestures. You know, he's like, I don't know. I don't know what he's thinking. I don't know if he's a threat.
Mitch is rumored to have been rescued from a cult by his mother, which my character believes. There are those kill your darling moments, and we took out an entire scene where we go to Mitch's house. My editor was absolutely correct that it slowed the narrative down, but boy, did I love Mitch's mother. I'm sorry she's not there anymore.
Isn't that hard? Can you use her again someday?
Always.
All right, well, so since Mitch came up, I want to read something else. If you don't mind my reading something from the book.
Sure.
Okay, so... his name is Mitch Mitchell, and then Chris is out with his friends Wexler and Anna, and I'm going to just read this. And then, out of the next long silence, and once we were back to just staring up at the sky, Anna quietly said, "Do you think his middle name is Mitchell?" Something about the timing of it was explosively perfect. You could feel the funny, and we all burst out laughing in that way that uses up all of the air in your lungs at once, the kind that hurts. I rolled off the car and fell onto the ground just to do it, and Anna screamed with laughter, like it was the only way to get more out. And I'm not doing justice to it because I've just taken this out of context and read the paragraph, but it's on the tail of a conversation that's fairly deep, as I recall, and it's just this funny little exclamation point at the end of that scene. And actually, after that, there's another paragraph that's just beautiful that I'm going to read later. But I wonder if you can talk about describing a funny moment well, because I think that's hard to do. It's really hard to represent that kind of hilarity among teenagers lying on their car looking up at the stars at night. So
I'm so glad you read this book. You really have, you're telling me my process, and you're liking the things I like about it. And that was a very hard moment to write, and I didn't anticipate that it would be. Yeah,
I was laughing out loud when I read it just at home. I didn't do that right now because it makes it hard for people to understand what I'm saying. But.
Right. Yeah, you can sit in your office alone and write and write and write, and the things that seem funny, you're like, am I punchy or is this genuinely funny?
Yeah.
And the core of that, when Anna screams and I dash screamed with laughter to get more out, that actually was an actual moment from my teenage years and from the character on whom Anna is primarily based.
Yeah.
So there's something of sense memory that you can invoke. You know, what was I feeling physically, or what was I seeing? You know, a little like impressionism. What exactly do you see? And then try to recreate it without embellishing.
Right.
It feels a little bit analogous to me that way.
Yeah. And I think it is important that the scene that preceded it, which unfortunately I don't have to read right now, but I don't have on the page, is serious.
Yes.
And so it kind of... It all works together to make it funnier.
And ultimately, you want every action that the character chooses to do double duty, as I call it, to do more than one thing. So
yes.
It breaks the tension. It also speaks to Anna's non-seriousness about the threat that they've been discussing.
Yes, right. Now, this, I think, is actually from earlier in that same evening. There's just this funny line, but it also brings info in by way of dialogue, which I think is something you have to be really careful about. But this is a funny thing. So he says, I think it's Chris. Chris and Wexler are recalling a night at work when they worked together at this place called Smiley's. And I think it's Chris that says, that was the night we were seeing who could talk the fastest to customers without them noticing.
Real life. We would talk fast. We would talk slow. We would talk cold. We'd stand at the takeout window. Hi, can I help you? Just to entertain ourselves.
So that was both funny and also kind of creates a tiny little micro scene for us without giving us the whole scene, right? Because all of a sudden, because we already know these characters, so we can picture them doing that.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
Over the years, I've learned to maximize my details. My very first novels had a football element to the story. I know nothing about football, but I learned a little and used all of it. And several people said, oh, I read your book. I didn't know you knew about football, which...
Isn't
I still
that
didn't,
interesting?
But if you can leverage those details.
Right.
Yeah.
I had a professor in my MFA program who used to say the similar thing. Like, if you use exactly the right details, the things that you do know, readers will bring what they know to that experience because you've started to bring them into it, and they finish it. They fill it out.
It's vaguely, I forget what the name of the concept is. It makes me think vaguely of the analogy of the principle on which film is based. We're really just seeing a series of still photographs, and your brain does the rest.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. I want to bring up one of the reasons that Chris so hates his father, and it really is hatred, at least. Yeah,
for him.
One of the reasons he hates him so much is not just that his father left his mother for another woman, but he left without a conversation. He did not have the conversation with his son, his children. He left notes for them. And I'm not going to read the note, but it's actually great how Chris presents it to the reader. It's serious and it's sad, but he also he presents the paragraphs that were in the actual note, and then he breaks them up with his editorializing, where he's sort of just like taking away from what his father's saying and counteracting it with truth, or, you know, with his opinions. And that seemed kind of fun. I wonder if you can talk about writing that letter and the asides. And I'm wondering if you wrote the letter first and then put in the asides.
That was one of those semi-magic writing moments. I like that passage as well. And it just, I wrote it completely as it appears on the page. I mean, I edited it later. But as a basic idea, it just sort of flowed out of me.
Right.
And I certainly was deep into this idea of the relativity of truth, as I've mentioned before. So,
right.
You know, there's Dad's letter, and then there's what he was saying, but then there's what he was really saying, and what he was really saying that he was aware of, and what he was really saying that he wasn't aware of. And so I was toying with all of that, giving Chris's commentary throughout.
Yeah. Okay. Now there is a kind of like friendship triangle aspect to the book.
Yep.
And I wonder if that just seems like a very kind of universal experience of high school in some ways, you know, or college. I mean, I just think there are moments in time where friends start to fall for each other and maybe other friends get left out.
Yes.
So was that important to you when the book started, or did that sort of happen organically on the page as well?
It wasn't part of the original inspiration for me, but I found it very quickly, partially based on my own experience. Even though I wasn't even out to myself in high school, I knew what it meant to feel alienated from the kids who were hooking up.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that that wasn't a kind of relationship or romance I was likely to find while I was there in high school. So, that's one of those emotional truths I talked about before.
Right. Now, is this book, I'm sorry, I'm not remembering seeing the in the literature if it's being marketed as YA or if it's just being...
It's being marketed as YA.
It is, okay.
Which more and more has crossover appeal these days. More and more adults are reading YA.
Yeah.
And that's my hope.
That's why I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it while I was reading it.
Good.
Okay, speaking of reading, I wondered if you have any books that you've read lately that you might recommend to people who are listening.
I do. I write middle grade fiction, YA fiction, and I also read adult fiction, so I'm going to give you one of each of those things.
Oh, great.
My middle grade favorite middle grade read of the year is a book called The Bridge Home by Padma Venkatraman, which is just it's a gorgeous treatment of kids on the street of Chennai, India, which sounds very bleak, but one of the things I love most in literature is when people can find genuine, uncompromising beauty alongside the ugly parts of their characters' lives without giving up either one.
Right.
It's a stunning book, but also a quick, interesting read. There's a YA novel that I've loved this year, which has another what I would call incidentally queer character. Darius the Great is Not Okay by Adib Karam.
Okay.
And it follows his American-born character to Iran to visit his grandparents.
Oh.
And again, his sexuality is not really a part of the story, but it's there in the background as he deals with other things, including depression. It's a beautifully wrought story. And again, a relatively quick read, by which I mean it's a great story, but it's not too weighed down by itself at all.
Okay.
And then Min Jin Lee's Pachinko is my adult book recommendation.
Okay.
Follows four generations of Korean folks, many of whom over the 80 years of the book live in Japan, where I had no idea Koreans face a lot of prejudice.
Oh.
And so we follow that whole family for all of those years and years and years, and we see how that family develops. Also a fascinating book.
Yeah, that sounds good. Those sound like great recommendations.
Good.
I'm reading one now that has to do with Korean Americans, well, Korean immigrants. Miracle Creek, have you heard about that?
I haven't.
So that's, is her name Angie? I'm going to have to look it up and put it on my website. But anyway, so that's another good one too. What are you working on now? What are you writing?
I am superstitious about saying too much about what I'm working
on.
But I've always said that I admire the chameleons more than the specialists.
Okay.
I like to write as many different kinds of things as possible. There's a guy who writes for YA and middle grade picture books, M.T. Anderson.
Yeah.
You know
Tobin,
him.
He's been on the
show. Oh, awesome. Yeah. Great guy, an amazing writer. That's the kind of career I aspire to.
Yeah.
So I've left the contemporary realism of Me, Myself, and Him for this comedic, and I would even say ridiculous, but in a good way, middle grade adventure story that I'm working on right now.
Oh, wonderful. Now, I'm trying to think. He's very prolific, right? I mean, M.T. Anderson, he does a lot of different types of work as well. I think when I interviewed him, it was about a graphic novel that he had written.
I've lost track. He has so many great things.
Yeah, and he wrote Feed, right?
Feed is my go-to recommendation of his. Yeah, it was very prescient when it was written.
Yeah, okay, great. I want to ask you a question. I like to always include a question offering advice to listeners who are writers.
Yep.
So when it comes to describing his summer in Ohio, which is one of the timelines, as I mentioned, as we've talked about, I love the settings that you create for Chris and his friends to hang out in. And I want to just, if you don't mind, I'll read a couple of them.
Sure.
Okay. So this is, you know, the summer after graduation from high school. It's the last summer before they get to go, before they go their separate directions in the fall. I mean, I think there is an aspect of Chris that's like, I get to go my own direction. He's ready to kind of burst out and go somewhere different.
Yes.
But okay, just a few little setting things. This is one of them. I don't know what the platform used to be. Now it's just four wooden legs and a bunch of boards about 3 feet off the ground in the middle of the golf course. And we call it the golf course, but it isn't one and never was. That's just so great. Like, we don't know what the thing is and we don't know where it is, but we do know that it's a platform on a not golf course.
Right out of my childhood.
All right, great. Then there's this great old amphitheater where larger groups of kids hang out at night. And this also really reminded me of how it is when you're a teenager and you want to be with your friends and you don't want to be with your parents. And so you just go out looking for places to hang out. And that was a good one. And then this is from that scene that we already talked about where Mitchell might have the middle name of Mitchell and everybody laughed. But after that, Chris muses, and for a while anyway, the corn stood vigil and the stars went into or out of alignment, whatever they were doing that night, and it was all lanes open ahead, just a straight shot down the highway of that summer, doing this with them, being there exactly where I'd want to be, and whatever else happened, there would always be that night and every night we had left that summer, along with all the ones we already had that would always be. So that's beautiful. That's more than just setting, but the setting informs that feeling that he has so deeply. So I wonder if you have any advice for listeners who are writers about writing setting.
That's a good question. In workshops, I certainly start with some of the basics, and I ask I ask them to make a list of how that setting would hit each of the five senses.
Mm-hmm.
Smell can be a difficult one, but you know, come up with what you can, and then try and write a scene which will probably be overwritten in which you hit all of those senses.
Okay.
Just to sort of start getting it in your head. I'm also a filmmaker at heart. I was a film major in college, and the thing I think about with setting quite often is what's the first thing the character would notice?
Mm-hmm.
Not what do you want them to see. What would the character notice when they first walk in?
Okay.
And point your camera at that. Show us that first, and then what would they notice?
Right.
And then what? And it can give some verisimilitude to the character in that situation, and it can also direct you as a writer, because you know quite often what we're struggling with is picking from the 3 billion details.
Yes.
You know, and which ones do we want to show?
Right.
So put it through the eyes of the character.
All right. That's great. And I'm only pausing because I'm thinking, and it depends on what the character's mood is at that moment too, because
that's another exercise, right? The same setting from 3 different frames of mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you. That's great advice. Now you do teach, and you lead workshops, and
yep.
I'm curious, when you teach, do you, I'm trying to remember what you are teaching. I did announce it on the show last week. You're doing a workshop tonight.
I am, yeah.
And what's that one on?
Tonight we're doing a manuscript workshop at the Pride Center of Vermont. Our first week, it's been a 3-part workshop, and the first week was based on improv and play for writers,
okay.
Which is a favorite topic of mine.
Yeah.
As a practical matter, I use improvisational techniques, but as a means for getting the writing done, not for warming up to the writing.
Oh, fun.
Then last week was the essentials of story, character setting, and conflict. And then tonight people are going to bring in manuscripts and get some feedback. And if we have time, we'll also be talking about getting unstuck and, you know, how do you actually get the writing done, which is such a big question.
It is, yeah. So that's what I was going to ask. So how do you approach the sort of large subjects within a writing class? And I don't know. I always, when I teach, I sometimes have trouble keeping it on track because people also want to like tell you what they're working on, or it has a way of So how do you manage that?
I mean, at the end of the character setting and conflict workshop last or 2 weeks ago, one of the students said, well, that was about 6 hours worth of material in 90 minutes. Yeah. So living, you know, sort of tweak and tweak as you go. I would rather have more than not enough, of course.
Yeah.
And beyond that, you know, trial and error, I've learned to become a little more comfortable. One of the exercises I tried to do at that last workshop, everybody did wrote the wrong, I realized I was giving the wrong instructions.
Oh, okay.
That would have been much more embarrassing to me once upon a time.
Yeah.
But you know, it's the throw stuff at the wall and see what works and know if not that, then this kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. And if multiple people had trouble with it, then they know that it's not them and it's just a miscommunication.
That's right.
Well, so I did ask if you might have a prompt that you could share with us today.
I do,
and
yeah.
In the show. So what might that be?
I picked this up from Matt De La Pena. Anybody in Kid Lit like I am will know that name. He suggests, it's one of the most useful exercises I've ever done, writing a letter to yourself from your character, explaining to you what you're getting right and wrong about him or her or them.
That's wonderful.
And it's been very productive for me to try that.
Oh, that's great. Did you do that with Chris?
I did, a couple of times.
Oh, wow. And that's funny because he's sort of got overtones of you. So what were you getting wrong?
I'm curious. I'm trying to remember. I don't know if I have an answer for that.
Okay.
It was so long ago.
That's okay.
Yeah.
It's also maybe kind of a personal question. What are you getting wrong about yourself?
More so, yes, exactly.
All right. Well, that's great. Well, I want to thank you so much, Chris Tebbets, for being here. The book, again, is Me, Myself, and Him, published by Delacorte Press. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It flew by.
If you want to learn more about the work of Vermont author Chris Tebbets, you can find him at christebbets.com, and that's T-E-B-B-E-T-T-S. And he's on Twitter at Chris Tebbets. Sorry, I thought there was an extra letter in there. Chris Tebbets. So that's easy. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And you've just heard an interview with Vermont author Chris Tebbets about his new book, Me, Myself, and Him, which is published by Delacorte Press. So thanks to my show, I have a lot of books, and I love books, but they are starting to occupy more space than I have available. So I've said this a few weeks in a row. I'm doing a book giveaway. If you're interested in one of the books that you've heard about on this show, you may go to my website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com, and use the contact tab to ask me for my copy of the book you're interested in. If I have it and you're the first one to ask me for it and you live in an area with domestic U.S. postal rates, I will send it to you. I will pay the shipping. You may ask for a recent book or an older one. I don't have all of them anymore, but I would love to share any that I do have with other readers. So just so you know, shelaughswithoutus.com. Go to the contact tab. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available at writethebook.podbean.com and on iTunes, Spotify, and other places where podcasts are found. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com, as I mentioned before. If you have a guest to suggest for the show or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM. WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Have a great week.